it does define people here too. We have an approach to the process this morning. You're all very welcome. That is the DTI here. I know that the DTI was sending their legal people here this morning, and so we're very pleased that the legal office and others are with you. So who's leading, in a sense, the delegation this morning, just so we know? Yes, so if you can then, we would then want to welcome yourself. Is that, don't tell me, because I do know, is that Advocate Rory Holler? That's it. I just want to check the actual thing. It's Legal and Regulatory Services. Right. Now, can you introduce the team, and then we can proceed.
Thank you, Chair. On my left, I have Mr. Hans Fredel, the Legal Services, Department of Trade and Industry. On my immediate right, I have Advocate Philip Grunner. He's also from Legal and Regulatory Services of the Department. We have the State Law Advisor, Mr. Theo Hercules. And we have Mr. Shibuya Mungutugu, who is an initiative drafter within the department as well. Thank you, Chair.
I'm not sure that we have that last name.
Shifiwe Mavutugu.
Right, okay. You're very welcome. Now to explain the documents and how we're going to deal with it. The DTI are simply here, and I shouldn't perhaps say simply, they're here in a very valuable capacity, and that is, as we move clause by clause, on one hand, they're right at hand to clarify certain issues. But before we even undertake that, you will recall that we did refer a number of the issues to our own advisor, and that is Advocate Kathy Idenson from the University of Cape Town, it must be, yes, the Department of Commercial Law, who also gave through an opinion on certain issues. We have that. We also received a legal opinion from the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development here in certain matters. Unfortunately, as we only had one copy at the moment, it has just arrived on the desk. We are going to get others made. Our approach to the issue today is to tackle first what we have received as the legal opinion on some of the issues that were flagged late last week when perhaps some of you were not present, and after that to go clause by clause on the matter itself. So I'm going to hand over at this point to the committee secretary, and that is Mr. Andre Hermans, and in front of you, you will, of course, see the department. He's going to take us just through the relevant sections. Some of you may not have been here at the time that those issues were being flagged, but nevertheless, you will, of course, want to know. Thank you to everyone. I'm aware of only one early... I'm not sure if you're in this meeting totally, Honourable Ambrosini, or just in body. But I know that you have requested to leave early on a Chief Whip's matter. And Honourable Impashlele, the same applies to you, and I understood the Honourable Kotsi, is that correct? And that situation was 11 o'clock, I heard. Right, thank you. So we will now proceed. And there are no other items on this agenda today.
Hi, good morning, members. In your package that you received this morning was a document dated 14th and 15th of February from Kathy Idenson from the Department of Commercial Law. It relates to the issues that the committee requested her to give an opinion on. And the document dated the 15th was the additional issues that was also identified by Manco as someone and the committee that she was requested to express her view on. Now, the chair has requested or indicated that she just wanted me to highlight those two documents, and she will personally take the committee through those particular clauses and issues that were highlighted by Cathy.
The first issue is reckless trading and other implications of technical versus commercial insolvency. Are we all in agreement here? We know where we are. We've got the document. I would hope that DTI and the team also have the document in front of them. In other words, when I was walking in, I saw the one of our own consultants sitting behind me, Mr. Palmer. Still here, and also Treasury, who is here as well. Sorry. You're also very welcome. But if we look here then, you will see that Section 22, as read with Section 4 of the Act, the provisions of the Act and the Bill. Section 22.1 of the Act prohibits reckless, grossly negligent, and fraudulent trading and trading under insolvent circumstances. Then goes on to point to the actual section, and if some of you want to flag or, you know, note that on your documents, if the Commission has reasonable grounds to believe that the company is engaging in conduct prohibited by subsection 1, the Commission may issue a notice to the company to show cause why the company should be permitted to continue carrying on its business or to trade as the case may be. Thus, effectively, it empowers the Commission to cause companies to cease trading if they are in insolvent circumstances, unless they are able to satisfy the Commission that they ought to be permitted to continue operating. The concept insolvent circumstances is not defined, but may be interpreted as including companies that trade while they are technically insolvent and that their liabilities exceed their assets. This interpretation is based on the fact that Section 22.1 refers to reckless trading, grossly negligent trading, and trading under insolvent circumstances. In terms of the general rules of statutory interpretation, this implies that each of the three concepts has a different meaning. Since the courts have already determined that reckless trading refers to trading while commercially insolvent, that is, while a company is unable to pay its debts as they fall due, in the ordinary course, at least for a certain future period, their implication is that trading in insolvent circumstances means trading whilst technically insolvent. That is the interpretation of that section in her opinion. Okay? Goes on to indicate the number of submissions, etc., that should either be deleted or at least amended on rounds, etc. A large number of companies. So she's actually managed to classify these different submissions. A large number, particularly those that are newly incorporated or affected by currency fluctuations, operate whilst they are technically insolvent. Two, many such companies are able to pay their operating expenses and other debts in the ordinary course despite technical insolvency. As such, they do not represent an undue risk for creditors in the same way that commercially insolvent companies do. And the section fails to take account of this commercial reality. Insofar as Section 22.2 does allow companies to be required to cease operating if they are technically insolvent, it is a new and unnecessary and addition to our law, particularly since creditors are already adequately protected, etc. Four, the failure to distinguish between technical and commercial insolvency and the inclusion of technical insolvency within the ambit of Section 22 also has the following additional knock-on implications. Directors of technically insolvent companies will be unable to benefit from the indemnity and insurance provisions of 78 of the Act. If it will require directors of technically insolvent companies to adopt a resolution placing the company under business rescue proceedings, alternatively, to send a notice to affected persons informing them of the company's position, including the fact that it is technically insolvent. This will have adverse implications for the company's reputation and may affect its future viability. She goes on then to point to the technically insolvent companies that are audited and the SMEs. The main issue is that her opinion is in agreement with the submissions that section 22, and this is the important paragraph, should be amended so as to make it clear that it only refers to commercial insolvency, which should be defined with reference to section 4 liquidity criterion, but not to technical insolvency or failure to satisfy section 4 solvency criterion. I'm going to just check immediately here with DTI and the legal people who, of course, this is just like looking at their fingertips and hands, palms, whether you directly tackle this matter and how.
Thank you, Chair, for that opportunity to consult. With the team, we have tackled the issue, Chair, in the sense that we have amended the section to remove trading under insolvent circumstances as an offence in terms of the stopping of the trading in terms of Section 22. But what we've also done, if you look at the sections within Section 22 and in the new proposed amendment, we have, in a way, indirectly put it in the sphere of commercial insolvency by stating that it only becomes an offence prohibitable or a conduct prohibitable if the company is unable to pay its debt as becomes due and payable in the normal course of business. That is the commercial insolvency aspect of it.
And that is, we know, in one of your responses that you've given us. Because in the opinion, if you look here on page 5, goes on to say, if, however, it is decided to retain, but already we've taken a, you know, DTI have indicated a different position there, goes on to say in the third line, if it is to include trading whilst technically insolvent, the definition should refer to a contravention of relevant portions. That now would come out. In other words, the opinion has already, you have already addressed what the opinion has put forward. Members of the committee. Yes.
Comrade Chair, I'm new at this rather complex piece of legislation, but I just wanted to point to a paragraph in the opinion on page 5, the last paragraph before 3, which says, if it is decided to retain Section 22, the intention is to apply for technical, then I would suggest that at least the concept of trading under insolvent circumstances is defined. Now, is that defined? Because you pointed to that in terms of the new clause. I hope I'm reading from the right document.
No,
thanks.
You're quite right. Honourable Ambrosini.
Madam Chair. Madam Chairman, I would like to ask a couple of questions of the presenter, but since the presenter is not here, perhaps the DTI can help me understand it. And I really ask, against the background of ignorance and lack of familiarity with what is, for me, a strange provision. Sorry, 22.
I may just point out that a consultant will be here on Friday, just so that members are aware of that.
My concern is we're dealing with things which are profoundly different. Recklessly, gross negligence, and with the intent of the fraud. Now, these qualifications are irrespective of whether it's technical, commercial, insolvency. the substance that people will trade when there is no money, when they are insolvent, because they have a good faith expectation to make money. You look at the situation with Steve Jobs and the many times that Apple went up and down. They were technically and commercially insolvent. The guy believed in it. He knew he could do it. He was reckless under any business standard. He built the largest company in the world. It is part of the entrepreneurialness to be reckless. And if we get courts of law to apply legal standards to what is reckless in business and what is not reckless in business, it doesn't really fit there. Reckless driving, yes. Reckless business conduct, no. And I don't understand it. The intent to defraud, I understand. It's the intent to defraud is clear. You know that you're not going to make it. You're trying to get as much as possible from the creditor, pay your salary, pay your expenses. That's a legal test that is understandable in court. Perhaps gross negligence may also be understood, but surely business, recklessly, I find it very problematic. Is it just me, or is there a reason behind it?
I want to just proceed with Honourable Harris before coming back.
Thanks, Chair. I would just appreciate, if I may, the opinion of the DTI on the technical advisor's statement that at the bottom of page 2 of her memo. Since the courts have already determined that reckless trading refers to trading while commercially insolvent, which perhaps speaks to what Honourable Ambrosini said, and then over to the next page, the implication is that trading in insolvent circumstances means trading while technically insolvent. Now, although the proposal is that the clause is, or the section is restructured slightly, I think the advisor is still correct. And I would value the DTI's position on whether the court precedent on reckless trading therefore means that trading under insolvent circumstances means trading while technically insolvent. Thank you.
Honourable Kotsi.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think this question of insolvency has been coming through with committee members. And I think the more we deal with it, I think it does get clarified. My issue here, Chair, is that we cannot deny the company that is breaking even. Because I think we also spoke about small businesses who at least can break even. But if it can be done in such a way that it does not regard those ones as insolvent, but insolvency does take place, or maybe reckless. I think at some stage we're saying reckless should be defined, but it should not include those companies that can actually break even. Therefore, however it is actually put in the bill, it should not include those people because it will be denying them while they can actually break even to the match.
And I just wish to, sorry, that your hand, Honourable Salam.
I think, Chairperson, we need to be careful not to try and put in the act what should appear in the regulations. I mean, if the act generally refers to recklessness, we cannot go in detail in the act to go into what recklessness would mean. The regulations are supposed to deal with that particular issue in context.
Thank you, Honourable Salah. Honourable Smala.
Actually, I think the idea is that we've got to make it as simple as possible. And for us to maybe look at section 22A and then try to put those wording of reckless and gross, all those three or four different meanings of what it is in there. Why not put commercial or technical insolvent? Because why not put the wording in there to say if a company is commercial insolvent, the commission can do the following, and then just deal it in that sense, and then take that wording out, and then define what is commercial trading, maybe in the in the preamble or in the words of that. In the definitions maybe, and then define it as that, and then that's how I would see it. That's just a suggestion. Thank you.
That is the opinion of the advisor as well, that a particular issue should be, we should define it, have it defined within the Act. Right here, as I pointed out on page 5, if it is to include trading whilst technically insolvent, the definition should refer to a contravention, etc., etc. But before that, she indicates that if it is decided to retain it, I would suggest that at least the concept of trading under insolvent circumstances should be defined. That is her opinion, that is the proposal that she is advising. She is our consultant, she's not DTI, so that's the advice she's given to us under the circumstances. The reason I asked for DTI's comment is a lot of the material we've just got recently, as you know, and we may not have all had the opportunity to assimilate three responses as one to ensure that it was covered. So we checked with them before, of course, doing our own checking. Are we going to settle with what the advisor has put forward, or is DTI referring us to a recent response which has dealt with this? Thank you. DTI. Now let us hear DTI.
I think
insufficient has been said for DTI to tackle the issue, because even in your absence, Honourable Ambrosini, this issue has been thrashed out before DTI. That's why we took it to the consultant and said we have a challenge here. We can't seem to understand exactly what the issues are. As long as it's going to be literally 30 seconds, yes.
We are in the process of uniforming commercial practices across the world. That's what OSHA is doing. Would you be interested in the position of telling us if in any other jurisdiction there is any similar provision where a company is prohibited by law to trade if insolvent and how it's dealt there? Not now, but as we go ahead with the deliberations.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I should begin by just looking at the current construction of Section 22 of the Act. Subsection 1 is a prohibition on any company to carry on business recklessly with gross negligence or intentionally fraud. And Part 2 thereof is a prohibition to trade under insolvent circumstances. And that's where the whole problem starts. So when the DTI had to re-look at this, it seemed necessary to change Section 214 of the Act, and that is done in Clause 112 of the Bill.
If I'm just interrupt, that would be page 66 of the Act. Right. And carry on.
And then Clause 112 of the Bill, which actually amends the
I just
thought, Now, Clause 112 just amends. If you just get the page here.
There's no footing on here. This one.
Is that 112?
Clause 112, yes. It means the sanction that is linked to the initial prohibition in section 22. The initial proposal by the DTI in the bill was just to change the sanction and make it not an, and prescribe no sanction for trading under insolvent circumstances. But that proposal was not met well by the public and the people that testified before this committee. And on a relook, the proposal was made to actually take the whole trading under insolvent circumstances situation out of the ambit of the prohibition and not prohibit such activity, but to empower the commission, if a company so acts and trades under insolvent circumstances, to allow the commission to actually look into the matter, and if that company cannot prove that it is in fact commercially solvent, then it could have been ordered to stop, to cease trade. So it's not a prohibition anymore. No outright prohibition, and it's not an offence under the proposal. It is only a red light that goes on that warns the commission that this company might be a danger to the creditors. So it can issue a compliance notice to this company to indicate whether it is in fact commercially solvent and can pay its debts as they become due in an ordinary course of business. I think if one looked at it from that point of view, a number of the concerns that were raised now around the table would basically fall away. Also, the proposal indirectly then defines what is meant by trading under insolvent circumstances. It says it is trading under circumstances where you actually cannot pay your debt as they become due. So there's an indirect definition as was proposed by the consultant, and the whole structure has been changed to no longer make it a prohibition, but to just put a red light on for the commission to investigate and make sure that the company is in fact capable to operate.
I see. Am I correct that that response came from you, written response, on the 28th of January?
I think it was the 28th of January, that's correct.
Yes, because I see here on the page of that same document, on page 5, from DTI, you indicate exactly the point made, because it was the issue raised in the committee and in the submissions that had been before us. And you probably then more eloquently, having studied your thoughts, put it down in writing here. As you indicate that it proposes, DTI, that reckless trading should be separated from trading in insolvent circumstances. Section 22.1b provides authorities with tools to intervene earlier, but also it prevents the measure that should deter companies that trade under insolvent without affecting startup, which was our concern, that it may affect a startup. But the next point was in relation to 22.2, where you say, therefore, 22.2 clearly gives the intervention powers where there is a sign of danger to facilitate the effective take-up of business in good time. Those issues of concerns had been raised by KPMG as well as BUSA, as well as Deloitte and Eskom, IOD, Weber and Wenzel, who were acting for a couple of companies, etc. But you've all got the documents. So what I want to, at this particular point, we have our own opinion, we have DTI's issues. We've studied this, considered it before. The issue is really, do we go forward with what has been said here in terms of our consultants saying possibly a further definition here for us to consider that, the committee, take what DTI has proposed, okay, or is that not acceptable to the committee? That's where we are now. we've heard everything, okay, I'm going to start from the bottom and come back here. And I want quick points now. Honourable Harris, Honourable Ambrosini, Honourable Smuller.
So my proposal would be that we could compromise. I think the department has found some kind of middle ground, but I maintain that the indirect definition that they talk about is perhaps a little bit too indirect. There's no clear link between the indirect definition and the actual term insolvent circumstances. So perhaps we should simply accept their proposal, but also insert in the definitions, in line with the consultants, an actual definition of the term.
Right, there's a proposal on the table, Honourable
Ambrosini. I think there is an additional problem which needs to be addressed. I think there is a prohibition. The fact that there is no longer a sanction, no longer an offence, doesn't eliminate the prohibition. The prohibition is set out in the first sentence of 22.1 where it says the company must not. That's the prohibition. And it is true that it is activated only once there is a notice from the commission. Well, this is recurring. 22.1, a company must not. And I accept the issue of the offense, but this determines the criteria of legality. So a director undertaking a type of conduct which is prohibited by law in no uncertain terms could expose himself personally to additional liability before the commission issues the notice. So I would like to have 1 and 2 rephrased in such a manner, which does exactly what you say that it should happen, merely empowering the commission to issue the note. And when the commission issue the note, issue the notice, at that point becomes prohibited. Should the commission become aware of this type of conduct, it may issue a notice. Once the notice is issued, the company should no longer do it, because otherwise the prohibition pre-existed. On the second issue of the definitions, I'm very wary for all of us to adopt legislation which would not fully understand, hoping that our doubts and uncertainties are going to be resolved in regulations. It's difficult for me to accept that words like recklessly, which are not clear, are going to be dealt with in regulations. It is our business. We have the law before us. I think recklessly needs to go out. Gross negligence needs to go out, because there is insolvency test, which is an either or. And in any case, if they don't go out, they must be defined.
Thank you. Try and get the order right here. Honourable Steinem. No, I thought it was Honourable Money.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to go on where my previous colleagues have stopped. I just want a point of clarity to ask that, once this section has been accepted as proposed, and I'm happy to accept the proposals made by the previous two colleagues in the committee, will we then argue that that companies at the end of their financial years will have to perform a solvency or a liquidity test as part of their annual statements, because you will have to come up with your annual statements to perform to say you are the technically or commercially insolvent? Will that be part of the annual statements to come up with a some sort of pronouncement in that annual statement? I just would like to understand that, and if so, then how do we address it?
All right. After this, we'll move on and see if we can take a position after the DTI has come in. If we can't take a position, it's flagged.
Thank you, Chair. Dealing with the issue Honourable Ambrosini raised, in our proposal to reword the section, we've done exactly what you said. We've removed the must from it being an offence in dealing with trading under insolvent circumstances, and moved it into the ambit of an inquiry being asked by the Commission. So we've done exactly what you
said.
We've done exactly what you proposed in terms of that. We haven't made an outright offence as such.
Lawyers talking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In dealing with the issue with Honourable Smiley, another great mind thinking alike, in the sense that we've also tackled the issue in terms of how is one going to report such instances. That is the reason why we made a proposed amendment dealing with reportable irregularities. So when an audit is done, in terms of the Auditing Professions Act, it has to be announced on a particular issue. The amendment proposed in the amendment bill is that reportable irregularities by independent reviewers are also tackled in terms of making a report to Commission and other regulators on the solvency of that particular entity. So that particular area has also been addressed accordingly.
As I said, after we've heard DTI's response, I think if you look, this is the document just on the side here. When was this handed to us? I know, it was the latest one on Friday. It's this particular one here. You should all have this. Do you not all have this? Because it actually totally addresses exactly what the issues raised now. So, I'm only just checking if you haven't.
This morning.
Yes. If you don't, then I think the committee secretary needs to ensure you get a copy. They have been on the table or emailed. Honourable Harris, I want us now on the committee side to begin to take a position. If we can't, then we're going to pass it.
Thanks, Chair. I just would appreciate that the DTI's view on my proposal that we insert the definition in the front of the Act.
Can I just stop you there? Our own consultant has proposed that. That becomes our issue here, you see. We have to ask DTI. We'll take a decision on that. So if we decide we want a definition, DTI will have to provide, we'll have to look with that.
No, I understand. I just, with your blessing, I would just appreciate their opinion on it, that's all.
All right, let's get
that. Chair, may I respond? Firstly, there are two things that we need to respond on. The one is the concerns about the meaning of business, carrying on business recklessly with gross negligence or the intent to defraud from Mr. Almasini. I think not the intention to define these concepts in the regulations. These concepts have been clearly defined in our case law over many years, and they have specific meaning in the legal fraternity, and there's no uncertainty as to what the meanings are, and we would not like to change or to involve ourselves in changing the position as far as the actual meaning in the legal sense is concerned. The question of the definition, I must be clear if we need to define technical or commercial insolvency. It could be more complex and it could be more complicated than we would have anticipated. If we can just make it clear in the section that will be amended that the type of trading under insolvent circumstances that we are looking towards, is the type where the person or the company is unable to pay its debts as they become due in the normal course of business. I think then we have succeeded in properly defining what we want to have as a red light for the Commission to investigate.
Right, now we have the response, so we're not going back to DTI. I want to make that clear at this point. We're now working within the committee itself on whether we flag it or we agree that we accept the position as it stands. Do we want to go forward with our own consultant position, which was made prior to receiving the responses from DTI, which you had emailed to you? Yes.
Sorry, Madam Chairman. I respect your ruling that we don't have the response from DTI. They gave me a response on the basis and I thought first there is a different document. And there is no different document, it's the same document I've cited.
which still says a company must not carry out its business regularly. So that's a, yeah, so it is a prohibition. It is prohibited. Might not have a sanction attached to it, but it carries legal consequences. Hmm? Yeah, exactly. So it is. That's the concern. What I was suggesting, which is what the colleague was proposing, is that the prohibition only comes, which is what you said, but it's not here, only comes once the commission has issued a notice. No notice, no prohibition, and here. Now, the other concern which has not been addressed, Madam Chairman, is that this issue of reckless conduct. I mean, I cannot think of any successful business which did not start recklessly. It is the nature of business to be reckless. And having, with all due respect, bureaucrats who have never been in business, determining whether or not one is conducting itself recklessly, it's absurd. And especially because it is over and above the solvency test. The solvency test is a different thing. So it is not solvency. It's something beyond solvency. Are you wasting your money? I don't know what it is, but it is, if you were only solvency, all we need to do is solvency. I don't have any problem with the notion of intent to defraud any person, because that's a fraudulence. That we know what it is. So any fraud is not insolvency. It's something over and beyond fraud and insolvency. It's reckless. It's gross negligence. Why should we care? Why should we stop the very entrepreneurial activities which have created the world we live in?
Right. That is your position, as you say, and I think it's clearly stated here. The committee, I think, notwithstanding that we have heard a verbal, perhaps slightly different or an additional interpretation from DTI indicating the notes could be issued by from the commission, etc., which would then be in addition to the comments which had come in the proposal. I hope members say that. But in the final analysis, that is exactly what we can factor in, what we have verbally received from them with what is written here, in terms of where we want to go with our draft. You know, as we begin to develop a draft, as we put everything together here and factor in after deliberating on these issues. So we're not going to go backwards and forwards. I want to propose that we, looking at the issues, we take forward the inclusive response that has been made by DTI in this respect. We take into account what our consultants have said as well. A lot of it has in fact been met in the second proposal. That has been acknowledged by many at the table here today. And we put our own drafters to work on the matter to come forward with something. In other words, to merge together the inclusion of the verbal addition today from DTI into the written response that we got as to how we would then amend the actual amendment, but in this case it would also be dealing with the Act itself. The main thing I'm referring to capture here as a content specialist is in fact what was said by DTI just as they began to interpret the proposal that was here. And have you got that?
Some of it.
You've only got some of it. Now, because this is going to be a really difficult one, Advocate Rory, can you just spell it out again, because that's what we want to capture so that we can begin to merge it all together. And we're not going to have a football match here in dialogue. We just want that for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Basically, the position of the DTI is such that we've removed the prohibition for trading under insolvent circumstances, as proposed by many commentators and many submissions made, by moving it to subsection 2 of the particular section 22, by now stating that
trading under insolvent circumstances will only trigger a red light for the issue to be investigated to by the Commission. It is not an outright prohibition in that sense, but only a way forward and a trigger in order for it to be investigated. What we've also done in subsection 3 is that we've now added a particular area dealing with what shall be looked at by the Commission in determining solvency, and therefore the issue of whether the company is able to pay its debts as they become due and payable in the normal course of business is the issue that will trigger whether it's commercial insolvency or technical insolvency. So we've dealt with that particular issue in terms of.
So, Honourable
Vandermeer,
have you
noted
that we're going to leave that one alone at this point, so we're moving on, if that's all right, Honourable Salah, because I think we then are making some progress. I just want to check on an admin matter with the committee secretary. Are you capturing this on any form of Hansard? You are? Good. Good. Right. Now, it doesn't mean to say... it's the end of the road for us. It means to say we're going to get this drafted back by the content specialist. I hope I'm clear on that point. Right, as we move forward. The next issue, and I'm just giving the opinion here now. You're looking at page 5. It spoke about the position of regulators under business rescue schemes. Another issue that has come up every time we have tackled this. And it talks about the section imposing a general moratorium on auditors under business rescue, except in certain specific circumstances, and which do not include regulatory action by regulators. Now, she looks at the submissions. You will study and read that yourself. If you go back here, of course, and you look at the same thing as to where that is dealing with under the responses which our own content specialist has put together for us, you'll see the summary. The opinion here is the purpose of Section 133 of the moratorium is primarily to protect the company and its creditors by ensuring that the company's assets are placed under business rescue practitioners' control and used for the benefit of the company and its creditors in accordance with the agreed rescue plan. Given this underlying rationale, the moratorium should only apply to proceedings involving assets which the company owns or is legally entitled to. It should not apply to assets that the company has, but which it holds for or on behalf of another person. Page 14, in terms of what the content specialist has given us, and as you see, this SARS, FSB, and National Treasury. And as you know, DTI had long consultations with these groups. Then she goes on to say that it is for this reason that Section 133.1e expressly states that the moratorium does not apply to proceedings concerning any property or right over which the company exercises the powers as trustee of a trustee. I am accordingly in agreement with SARS submission that the section should be amended so as to exclude action by SARS to recover employees' tax, UIF, withholding taxes and VAT, which are collected by the company on behalf of SARS, and which do not form part of the company's assets. Right, that's the end of that. Now, if I look here, and at the same time, look at the latest response we have from DTI, and they'll alert us to that just in a minute. In fact, it's right here in front of us. It does say here, though, if you look at it, that it is not the intention to exclude actions of regulators during this, etc., etc. In fact, this was re-emphasized that they hadn't wanted to compromise certain issues that SARS or FSB had were dealing with. It is proposed that an exception be created that a regulatory agency may enforce action provided it has given notice to the business rescue practitioner. It is further recommended that a provision be inserted in the bill to require the business rescue practitioner to notify the regulatory agency to which a company under rescue would fall of his or her appointment. Now, in the light of what you've just had from our consultant, do you want to make a further comment, DTI?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further comment, but we are in agreement with the proposal, and we have accordingly have amended the bill.
And we're still doing that, as you know. The English language is a bit tough. Thank you very much. Okay, so we don't seem to be having a real difficulty here, are we? We have an agreement with our own advisor. We appoint people here, which we ourselves don't have an issue with. I just see, I'm so sorry not to have acknowledged you, but a new face, and then I just want to look here, you know, very often see it's from the ANC, and that is Honorable Magwanya. 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 Is it a GW? Okay, Magwanya. Bum as in Mrs. Brigalia Bum. Thank you. Just to get the pronunciation. You're very welcome. And I hope your tenure and deployment here will be constructive for you as well as for us. Thank you very much. So we're going to move. You know, that was the one that was over. So we next come to page 7 of the opinion. The powers of business rescue practitioners in relation to company books and documents. You will recall this is what we grappled with at length about, and if you look here at the actual thing, it is of the Act 142, and that should be then on page 15, let's check, yeah, of our summary here, clause 86 of the bill. The DTI, in fact, recommended that an exception to the section be included, whereby documents under lawful possession are excluded. Perhaps they want to just clarify that again. In this regard, such an amendment should provide for the practitioners to be provided with the copies of the documents to be allowed to, or be allowed to inspect the documents without undermining the pending process. So in other words, copy the documents, look at the documents, here they are, don't take the original. Do you remember that discussion we had?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we, in the end, that was acceptable. I hope members are all listening. I thought that that had been acceptable to members because I hadn't really made a note here of flagging it. Mm-hmm. Right. So can we then just leave that and go to shareholder appraisal rights? That's on page 8 of the advisor's position, section 164. 164 will be, I suppose, the next page, 16, is it? Yeah. And also right here, that also refers to that, the only qualification to this section, she indicates 164.17, which provides that if there are reasonable grounds for believing that the payment would result in the company being unable to pay its debts, the company may apply to court for an order varying the company's payment obligation. If you want to look at the points being made here, 164, the DTI did not agree. So it clarifies the issue why they did not agree. Weber and Wenzel was the representing legal company, but it represented a couple of people. The opinion here is that the Act's solvency and liquidity and requirements reflect a general underlying theme of reasonable creditor protection against any conduct by companies that does or might result in an unacceptably high level of creditor risk. Payments to shareholders pursuant to an exercise of their appraisal rights is conduct that may have such an effect. As such, I am in agreement with the suggestion that the section be amended so as to oblige rather than entitle companies making such payments to apply to court to mediate the relevant competing interests in cases of reasonable risk of commercial insolvency. I'm looking at the DTI here. They did not agree. You've heard and seen and read what our own legal advisor has suggested. Do you wish to make a comment?
Chair, yes. I think the DTI did not disagree, but they didn't include it in any of the proposals made. In fact, it seems reasonable to rather have it as a requirement than just to enable or just as an enabling provision for the company to apply. So I think when the solvency and liquidity of a company will be compromised through such a appraisal right payout, a company must approach the court. We don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, can I just check? I know that there were one or two typos. Is that the typo where you remove the not then? Am I looking at the wrong thing? Page 16, am I just misreading it? DTI does not agree. Questions why dissenting shareholders and appraisal rights. I wonder, you know, if we're all on the same page. I know that there were one or two areas where I was advised that a typo had crept in, and on the third occasion or the first occasion where I misread and I added my own not when it was agreed. Let me give you a few minutes.
It is in fact that one that we didn't get our message clearly across through a typo or anything of that nature.
There's a knock is up.
That's true.
Oh, okay. So you were having as much difficulty as I have with these knocks. Okay. Thank you very much. That's out of the way. So in fact, we move with what our consultant is saying, the sum of submission is great. Okay? There's no longer an issue. Did you want to say something?
No.
Who else doesn't have a copy? I mean, we've got some new members here now, and you need to have all the documents so you can actually constructively participate, even though perhaps not fully informed at this level now. So we'll just make sure you get them, all right? Yes, I'm sure, you know.
And so it would be helpful even for us members to indicate, you know, when you're quoting from that document, because we've got so many documents in front of us.
Yeah. Well, what I'm referring to here is the written response of 28th of January. Members, at this point now, at this particular point. I'm going to ask you to study this document that the consultant has sent us, both everyone in the room. The consultant will be here on Friday, which is also helpful. And we're now going to start clause by clause. So for that purpose, what you need are to have written responses at the ready. You need to have the document like that, the 28th of January, at the audit share. You need to have this one here, which most of you do seem to have. Yes, this one should be the 9th. All right, there are two of those. It's a pity we haven't got a date, but this one, which says further note, says as discussed on the 11th of February. Do you see that? Further note. That's the one you should have asked. Now that one is the one at the request that ETR proposal has contained there, etc., was discussed on the 11th, and these have now been included here. So that's the document we're having. The previous one that you may have written a lot of written on, which I certainly have, obviously there's no harm in keeping it just there in front of you. The other document you should have is one drawn up, which I hope everyone has, by the content specialist. Is that right, Ms. Herling? Committee's recommendations for amendments to the committee company's amendment bill. She's been tracking us along here. We've got space for our committee decision. Now, if you look here, you will begin to see we move from definition onwards, the way we are going to go this morning. So this is a very critical document for you to have alongside you, because it guides you as to what you should have. Are we all in agreement then? Right, okay. Then we have additional amendment outside the scope of the bill. Those are the ones that deal directly with the Act, and without actually directly dealing with the bill itself. With both the DTI tackled some points here, and we have have also raised a few issues. So you should have both. All right. I know it's not easy. It's not easy for me as well. So in the list should be cleared of other issues. If anyone is missing this document, I have a spare one. Well, you know, it's called the committee's recommendations. Got it, right. And then, of course, you have your phone anyway. Right. Okay. And then the written responses, the 10th of February.
Yes, well, I mean, I think this is that handy.
That is the latest that came out this morning, as well as something that was recently photostated, which I'm not sure if you received this minute. Where is it? Oh, where you are. And the 10th of February, the written responses. That also. Another document that hit your desk today because it only arrived now. And that is the one from the Department of Justice, which I referred to. We will deal with it under Section 69 and 83 as we come to it. So we're not throwing it out, but as we deal with that area, we will deal with that input. Here we go. If you can get out the amendment bill. That's what's before us. At the same time, you get the committee's recommendations. I'm going to see if I understand this myself, but it refers to see page 310 of summary, page 23 response, page 23 of proposal, etc., etc., on the definition of clause 1.1. So we're now moving to the clauses under the definitions here. Clause 1, accounting records. Go there. Look here. All right. If you're looking at it here.
Call it chair.
Yes. Honourable
Mabasa? Could I make a suggestion? It does take us slightly back, but could we, because for today we are using about how many documents? I think it's about 6, if I'm not making a mistake. I wanted to suggest that we call them document 1, document 2, you know, document up to 6,
yeah,
because the titles are closely similar. So. And then if Andre, Mr. Hermans, could work on that briefly,
number
and then we will all refer to them in such a manner. Thanks.
All right. Let's just number them right now. The act would be 1. Yeah. The actual act. I mean, we are referring to the act from time to time. The act would be number 1. Okay, let me make, I think we all make a note of this ourselves. The amendment bill 2. Okay, the committee's recommendations for amendments to the company's amendment bill would be 3.
This one. Yeah.
Number 4. Number 4 will be those additional comments which amendments, just let me get that out.
Additional amendment.
Document 4 is additional amendments outside the scope of the bill. That's document 4.
14.
The one that I was using or referring to frequently, dated the 28th of January, written responses to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, the 28th of January, that'll be document 5. Okay, are we all together there?
No, not on that.
All right, just a minute. Let me not belabor the point because we not, don't want to deal with detail of that. But we had a committee at the last meeting. That is document 5, though, when we get to sum it up. It says it's dated the 28th of January. It is written, it is the DTI document, a written response to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. You remember they took us through blow by blow by blow. Do you remember when we went through with the advocates, you know, on each point? I mean, you were there that day as well as I was, but had to be. Okay. Then the other one is dated the 10th of February, also a DTI document. Written responses to the Portfolio Committee, etc. That is document 6. Remember with economic development. Right. Then we have document four.
No, that is.
That was document five. Document four comes from our content submission specialist. Additional amendments outside the scope of the bill. If you haven't dealt with it, you received it possibly today or in email or in your mailboxes. You should have got that yesterday, I think. Then you've got, it was handed out this morning. That was handed out this morning, so you can possibly still get it. Then you have document three, which is this one here called Committee's Recommendations for Amendments to the Company's Amendment Bill. That is the one that was also handed out this morning. Now, what you have handed out this morning, everyone should have. So you do have it. Right, you should all have that one. Then document
the summary of
the amendment bill.
This one is also important.
Document one, the act. Yes, Honourable Harris.
Second, I propose we add document nine, which is the summary of submissions.
Good point.
Yeah, that's true. I was reading.
Document nine, the summary of submissions.
Is it nine or eight?
Nine.
Nine. Yeah.
Document ten, our consultants. One dated 14, one dated 15. Let's just get the documents out so people can look at them.
So 10 and 14?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 14.
One is dated the 15th of February. And that's number 11. And the 10th was dated the 14th. So there are two documents from her. 14 and 15. They're going to be dated. The 14th will be number 10, the 15th number 11. The summary of submissions will be 9. Now we should have had that because it's been handed out 5 times.
It's the thickest document.
We're not going to be, you know, the summaries we've handed out repeatedly. So I hope everyone has them by now.
Some are nine.
They are so big, they're difficult to make further copies again. We're going to work through on that basis with that numbering system. Thank you for the proposal, Honourable Mavasa. Honourable Harris.
Referring to document three. It lists at the top a note which lists all the references. Can we perhaps just run through those 5 references and number them? It references 4 documents, and it would be useful if we then could add a number next to each.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just getting my documents together, having had to put them on one side as we were referring to.
I was just specifying that it's actually 4, not 5.
For the first one will be 9.
No.
The second one will be 5.
Oh,
yeah. The first one will be 4. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't give a rated or read it to it.
I hear you. But he's actually giving copies.
I don't know.
And
they're
organizing
something.
Yeah. Research. Yeah. Research. I just would like to ask that the committee section put a date on every single document that they issue, because it really is very confusing when you have similar documents but you don't know which one came before the other.
The
date goes at the bottom as a matter of course, as a header.
We have established that principle with intellectual property. It seems to have disappeared because it requires a stack format. So can we go back to that practice? I'm not sure who in your section was doing it, but someone has. All right. Are we all on track now? We've only got one document generally missing here, and that is document 5. I say generally missing.
5 and 6.
Okay. Okay. Do you want the secretary to read out what the documents are again, or is everyone satisfied? I don't want us going backwards and getting confused now. When we refer to a document, we all want to be on the same document together. Can we try to move forward then? And we're going back on the definition. Are we all on the same page then? It's good to have a little light turn. All right. I have started off. We are going to have a tea break at 11. But if you like, you can break now for food here. Because I'd really like to make a start. Page 5, the Amendment Bill is what we're looking at. Yes, Document 2. I think, there we are.
Document 2.
Above.
Yeah?
Above. Right, good. On your right team seat, the document 3 and 4 can be seen, but document 3 at this particular stage. As you go through to accounting records, do we have, and that was the one I was actually reading from, and I referred us to this. Okay. Right. Are there any areas you want to come up with? I'm just going straight through. If I don't see hands, we're moving. That's 1A, it's accounting records, an acquiring party, B, it goes on, alterable provision, it's a matter of referencing. I've written on mine, and I was assured that you dealt with all the referencing, is that right? This was an issue DTI raised, referencing. I'm just asking you, because we don't need hold ups on that one. All of the greater part of an asset, C, the amalgamation or merger. D, the asset. Audit and asset. I don't see a hand, we're not stopping. Yes, Honourable.
Well, Chair, we are actually looking at the amendments the DTI has proposed in document 7. Again, I thought you said we were doing 2. Because all these issues have been amended in document 7.
No, we simply, what we're looking at here is what was the actual requirement here. So if people have made their notes, I would assume we've all made our notes as we went along. Have we not done that? Pick up your document 7 if you feel that you haven't had an opportunity to study all of it, those of us who were not at the meeting in particular.
I think my question is, are we agreeing to what is written down in document 7 then? Or not?
On this, at the time of this, we said that we didn't have, the person who raised an issue is not actually here this morning. Well, I mean, they are here, but they're not here. I mean, the rest of us know that this was raised by Honourable Ambrosini. The rest of the committee never had a problem, you see. That's the issue. So, having said that, I'm not going to go over an issue in which we ourselves didn't raise an issue on it, you know, other than one member who hasn't indicated to me that he continues to have a problem on the issue. I usually note the personal concern, Honourable Ambrosini, who raised that particular one. Otherwise, the explanations that were given to us, which we deliberated upon at the time, were accepted by the committee, that we would pursue them. It wasn't something we raised outside of this, unless you want to raise something now.
No. I just need to know which we're agreeing to. Is it the original or the amendment that is put forward by the Department of Trade and Industry?
No, it is the amendment. When I say the amendment, it is the proposal that they have put forward. We said we would agree with that proposal.
Document 7.
So, can I ask committee members to do one thing? On the amendment bill, document 2, can you note C, document 7? And then you tick. That'll be a good way of us moving. So when you see document 7, Ms. Hurling?
Ms. Fabschuskel, my process on the screen, I'd also like to just note where we're agreeing that we are deleting things that we say so we don't have to come back to it.
All right. Let's come back to Clause 1 and Document 7, okay, and what we agreed on. In here, if you look at it, if you look at the deletion, we didn't disagree with what was put here. So if you look at the deletions that are being made here, that is what we are looking at. Until we actually, so by the insertion, what if we put forward here as a proposal comes under D. Do you see that there? It was the issue of access. Okay? Means a resource controlled by an entity as a result of part that. That's all come on what you're looking at now, okay, by the subsection for the definition of master of the following. Master means, and this was the person holding that office in terms of the Supreme Court Act, etc. So what you may wish to put here is just see document 7, page 2, whatever, if you don't want to write out the whole thing. Is that an order for all of us? Okay. And in fact, if you look at this here, it moves across the page, the actual deed. It goes on to page 3, if you like. Well, not, you know, not page. I'm looking at this document too. And you must conclude the whole thing right up to page 3. Are we all agreed? Margaret, mm-hmm. Are you there now as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then we're going to go to, within here, if we also look, those of us who are closer to that overhead, you've also got it there, so that's also quite helpful. You then will go to the issue of order, that's line 2, page E6, what is it, page 6, order. If we look on the document 7, see how this may have been tackled, if it was tackled in any way. It's not tackled directly in that particular document, now, correct?
No.
Okay. If you look at the summary, I don't want us looking at too many documents, you know, because I think that gets confusing. The DTI itself has got its own documents at the ready. It can come forth itself with anything, but they didn't hear, there's no notice change to what is there. So it stands as is. Okay? Right. Okay. We're all still on the same wavelength then.
Okay.
Then we go to still page 6 of document 3, the amendment bill itself, okay. Page 6 of, page 6 document 2. Okay, we're still on the same. We're working on the amendment bill document 2, and we're bringing in other documents to clarify or engage on. So that happens to be page 6 at the time. I'm checking what we've got here. They've got U by the stuff. Well, that's done. V, which is a non-profit company, etc., etc. They're asking for all that to come in. Then they're talking of a double D, which is a reference to security. So if we go further down here, H, I is I. So that was I, actually. Convertible securities. Okay? You referred to something called a double D here, if you recall. DTI. Do you remember the double D here? Under master. You see? So if you look here, you're looking from our side of things. If we're looking at document 2, page 6 here, you would be looking, if I'm not mistaken, here on the actual thing of these convertible securities here under I on the one hand, but you're actually looking at securities, which is page 7 of that same document, okay? And over there, you'd be looking at you. You see that there? Are we all on the same page here now? There was no, in here, when I looked for members, I'm not noted any particular member who disagreed with certain issues here. So if we're still at one on that, it means what we have here in document 7 holds, Margaret. We're getting pretty close. Okay. So you're now going to go to a double D, which comes after that master issue. Now, I just get the feeling we're not all together. That's why, you know, it's a double D. Page 8, that's a double B right at the beginning. Double D is much further down line 50. Well, all right, 49, but I mean it's roundabout there. Okay. It's a double D. All right. So if you come back to document 7, page 2, at the bottom of the page, you will see what was spelled out here. Now, I have raised, so, you know, where these things have been raised by members, I've also noticed. That was an issue raised. There were questions around there, but in the end, there are no objections, you see. Double D. So, unless you want to raise something now, if we go with what was put here. Are we all together? Right. Now we move, and we turn over the page here on page 3 of document 7. Okay. And then we're here on, still on the same amendment bill, document 2. That's the amendment bill. And we then go and proceed to clause 2. That's on page 9. Are we all following this then? Honourable Harris.
Hey, can I just check if Margot is keeping a sort of status of how we're doing on, in terms of those definitions, at least. If it doesn't refer to document 7, then the implication is that it wasn't amended. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
Look, I think it's useful to get the clarification now rather than later. This will take a bit of time while we're all getting used to it. I'm getting used to it as well. So let's just go steadily. All right, we're on page 9. That two that came up there, we did. There were some suggestions put forward. There were some questions here. Deleting, we've been pointing out that certain things were deleted there, which you note. Honourable Ambrosini raised the question in that regard. It's unfortunately, we can't keep on going backwards. If a member is not here, it really delays processes. And perhaps what we can suggest, Honourable Whip, Honourable Becky, is that in future, members who wish the points to be taken into account should make those available to the committee secretary, which we have said before on that kind of matter. Otherwise, it's difficult for us to keep on going backwards when someone's been away.
That's true.
Right. So we're going forward now. And we then go to clause 3. Are we all okay? That was the SARS, FS, BIR, BIA, and the rest of it. Okay. So I look here. Not sure who's Honourable Harris.
Sorry, Chair, I'm sorry to go back to it, but I'm catching up slowly. The proposal for the definition of member. There's a problem. There was a problem initially with the cross-reference.
Yes. That's fine.
So surely we should, that should be reflected in document 7 or the add.
All right. DTI, this was raised in your presence, as I'm sure you've noted. But you said that you were going to look into all the cross-referencing and referencing. Has that been done by now?
As you said, if I may, we indicated earlier to the committee that there will still be a number of purely legal technical changes to the bill. Having in the sense that they do not relate to any considerations of policy whatsoever, they do not relate to matters of law, they are purely like legal technical changes to the bill. For instance, where there might be an underlining in the bill that is just slightly too long, it should be slightly shorter. Needless to say, we are not in the habit of hiding those from the committee. We will be frank with the committee, and we will deal with all of those when you get to the stage of dealing with the actual A list or the so-called A bill. We will produce all of them, and needless to say, if anybody would like to ask a question on those, we will gladly respond, but they are purely technical in nature. For instance, they're on cross-reference as well.
Yeah, this is what come up here. Yeah.
There's still a number of those that we, in fairness, still need to deal with.
Okay. Yes, I don't normally take national treasury. You know, we don't. We want to sort of be as inclusive as possible. Yes.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. Just in respect of Clause 3 of the bill, you had mentioned subsequent to the presentation to the DCI, because they had referred to the principle that where there were more stringent provisions in other pieces of legislation, we were mentioning that perhaps it would be helpful for the purposes of the Act if that principle was perhaps clearly reflected in Clause 3 of the bill.
Is this not an issue that you, as you say, you ironed out with the DTI together in a bilateral, I would assume, and within the department? And then is this one of the issues you're coming back to us on as we approach the finality? You know, because we've got certain technicalities you will be dealing with.
Madam Chair, the position of the DTI was simply that if there are more stringent requirements in other pieces of legislation, particularly financial and tax legislation, they need to make those known to us so we can list it accordingly in terms of a particular clause. If you see the one that we have added in the proposed amendment, we took into account exactly that principle. In terms of moving forward, we require them to continue to do a process of looking at their pieces of legislation, seeing the implications of it in terms of the company law, and then informing us of the more stringent requirements, and then we can have a process of looking at it.
Well, let me regard that as an internal matter on the part of the interdepartmental issue, because we can't go to a whole lot of other departments at this stage. We have asked DTI to absolutely clarify the issues with National Treasury, and that is where we still stand. So you need to, when you come back to us, give us that firm issue. And then my appeal to National Treasury would be, we can't, you know, all this does really is begin to move into other areas which to some extent is outside the scope of what we're dealing with right now and outside the parameters of where we're moving. So I have made it clear to the DTI, this has to be sorted out. And as you know, that sorting out even goes on at cabinet level. So it's not as if it is simply dealt with here and so on. This gets past packed cabinet, where ministers are all present of the relevant departments. So I don't want to belabor that issue. It's the second time we've dealt with that, and we're not going to deal with it a third time. But we're going to come back to clause. Were you on clause 3? Because we said the cross-referencing, our decision at the last meeting was that as we complete the bill and our own drafting, we need to ensure that all those, that the numbering is correct in the first instance with the state law advisor will assist us on. Isn't that right, Advocate Hercules?
Thank you, Chair. We will be part of the process of checking those technical...
Including the cross-referencing, so that there is no misunderstanding. So that is what I'm not dealing with right now. What we're dealing with here is the substance of the actual, any amendments we wish to take on, we are going to make. Now, we had Honourable Salah, Honourable Harris.
Well, I was just trying to make a point that sophisticated as this seems to be, it seems to be talking, this document seems to be talking to each other.
Yeah.
And it is the language that will bring us nearer to understanding how it happened. My observation here says that the bill is referring to clauses and not to sections. So anything that says clause, you must look for in the bill. And anything that says section refers to the principal act. And then all these documents are talking to the two. Document 3 will refer to clauses, which means document 3 is only speaking to the bill. And then the bill speaks to the principal act. And is this document, the DTI latest document, that then says to you what actually has changed today.
Yes.
If we get that sequence right, then we can all be able to read four documents at the same time.
Well, I couldn't agree more with you. So I think what you've done is simply underpin most of our points we're trying to make. Thank you. Honourable Harris.
Chair, I think Honourable Salah's point underlined my very tired refrain that we need to make sure we get legislation right the first time, because it's incredibly complicated trying to deal with amendment bills. The point I want to make, Chair, I was juggling definitions when we dealt with Clause 3. And can I ask, therefore, that you quickly summarise, if somebody could summarise the request from Treasury, which I actually missed, the response from DTI, and what your decision was, if you don't mind.
The request from DTI? The
request from Treasury.
From Treasury. No, I've already said this is an issue raised at the last meeting, which I think you were at the whole of that meeting, you will recall, when this was raised. And we actually said all issues with National Treasury must be dealt with in a bilateral, and DTI must come back to us with a firm position. We stand by that. We have no different opinion to that. And in that respect, you know, I allowed for Treasury to speak here. I needn't have allowed that at all. I need to make that clear. Thank you.
So then, the implication is, unfortunately, aside from their bilateral engagement, that the fact that the proposal is that more pieces of legislation are added to this list, and surely that's something which this committee needs to consider ourselves. If we're amending the bill and the proposal is more acts should be added to the list, then we must work out whether we agree with that or not.
I'm sorry, I missed your point just then because I got a call from...
No, all I'm saying is it's an issue which this committee must deal with, and it mustn't be dealt with bilaterally outside of this meeting. That's what I'm suggesting.
I'm saying to you that we're not calling a National Treasury. That is what I am saying, because we had an assurance from National Treasury at the time that they were in engaging with the DTI. This is here before us as Parliament. We have told the DTI, with the DG present at one point, that when they come back with final issues, they haven't yet finalized certain areas. That's what they have said. On the cross-referencing, on the point that was made just now by National Treasury, these are issues which they are going to come back to us on. Now, if we agree that they are coming back to us, then I think we've got to wait for that, because we are still getting our own advisor on Friday, ourselves. So what I'm saying, if you want to flag that issue, because you're saying we've got to make sure DTI does come back to us on that, we can flag it, so that it alerts us to the fact that DTI, when they do engage us again on cross-referencing and various other matters, that this again is underpinned. But in the final analysis, we're going to make a decision in the committee. Yes.
Madam Chair, just to add to that, with the bilateral meeting that we've had with National Treasury, and there have been numerous ones, I think the coming back aspect is actually from the Treasury side. Because in the meeting that we held with them, we said, come back to us and tell us which pieces of legislation in your area dealing with financial matters and tax matters have more stringent requirements that you would like to add to the Companies Act. So basically, we put the ball in their court to say, come back to us, which they agreed to a certain extent. We still do not have a list like that. So from the DTI side, we don't know actually what to do in terms of that.
Right. I'm going to leave it there because we haven't closed this. All right? And I simply said, continue dealing with it and come back to us with final response on the matter. Okay, because I think that's fair. And I'm sure the National Treasury, if they want to pursue the matter, will pursue it at that higher level. Right. So, from our side, a member of the committee has simply said we want to ensure that we do get that response back from DTI. So that's why we're flagging it. So, referring, you have just flagged that issue as well. Then you need to go to Clause 3. And Clause 3 is just below that, as you can see. Okay, cool. No, there was still someone who had a question, yes.
Am I correct then that the Clause 3 in Document 7 is replacing everything
in the amendment bill?
No.
No. It's an addition. Yes, the addition in subparagraph I of paragraph B of the subsection 4 of the following subparagraph. Double H and 2. So those are additions there. So if we come there and we're looking at A, okay, and then you've got double H, sorry, I'm also just tilting here. Where am I?
Principal.
And if you look in the principal act here, that refers to another document that, what number is that?
One.
No, not that D, one that we referred to, which was the one Ms. Herving had just now, which was dealing with section, with the Act. What number was that? Five, it's four, it's six.
There is subsection 4 dealing with inconsistencies between this Act and any other national legislation. And then just a little bit lower down, we have paragraph B, once again dealing with possible inconsistencies, and then listing small Roman 1, all the Acts that will prevail over the new companies Act in the event of inconsistencies. And then we have in our document number 7 on page 4 two new national acts to be added.
That's document number 2.
Those two acts listed on top of page 4 of document 7, they will be added to the list that we find in section 5, sub 4B of the Principal Act. And if you just allow me just to make a very, very brief comment, Madam Chair, if we do refer to that list as it is currently in the Principal Act, we will see, for instance, that the promotion or the Public Finance Management Act is already there.
Yeah.
Just to mention one. The Security Services Act, to mention another one. And then, of course, these two to be added to the list. That is the proposal.
Page 38 of the Principal Act. So we're moving on from there. I just want to get to the bottom of that page, Clause 6. Clause 6 there, which is, I'm referring to documents now, is document 7 and document 2, which we've got in front of us all the time. But before we get there, there is clause 4. You're still entitled, obviously, if you want to raise anything. This isn't an area that has come up that we call for response on per se, the same as number 5. Okay. And then we had 6, which we flagged and ringed. Okay, Honourable Harrod?
Okay, just to confirm then, the proposal around Clause 4, which is that various things should revert back to P2R limits, that's included in the technical changes of the
Those issues, in other words, we haven't raised anything further than what we, as it was agreed, would be changed. The amendment, and I think, where's Ms. Herving? Is she still there? Right. You're aware of that as well, aren't you, Miss Hurley?
Yes, in the other documents.
Pardon?
Yeah, because there are some issues which are on document 4, 3. Yes, which we also, I don't know if you want to actually address them. I'm not sure if in clause 2 it is actually looked at whether or not, because the DTI has removed certain aspects of the holding company, but whether or not we want to leave it as a member of a group of companies is a possible thing which you may need to just decide on quickly, as well as the break-even clause, whether we're happy to just leave it in as is. And you are referring to clause 4?
Clause 2.
Are we
past
clause
2?
I was just wanted to clarify whether or not we have decided, we're accepting the DTI's deletion of the full clause. What I'm just questioning is whether we can be reverting back to a reference also to a member of a group of companies, whether we're happy with that or whether it also remains an issue.
Right, so let's ask DTI for the response.
Madam Chair, document number 2, which is the amendment book, page 9. That portion that we have between lines 20 and line 25, which is paragraph A of clause 2 of the bill. If the committee would accept the proposal in document 7, under clause 2 on page 3, the consequence would be that this whole amendment listed between lines 20 and 25 on page 9 of the bill will be deleted, will be omitted from the bill. It relates to the principle of applying the liquidity and solvency test to companies. So if this provision is removed and we have 10 companies and 5 of them do not meet or set, 5 of them do not satisfy the liquidity test, then the other 5 companies will remain unaffected. They will not then pay for the sins of the other 5 companies. If this provision is retained in the bill, the effect would be that the 5 companies who are still operating in solvent circumstances would be punished for the sins of the other 5 companies. So, in brief, the whole of clause 2A should be omitted from the bill if the committee would accept that proposal.
And that's something we accepted on the last occasion, you see, because I've written here deleted. But you're still having a problem then as the content specialist.
I'm just wondering about the implications of the clause is if the company is a member of a group of companies, we look at the aggregate assets of the company. What is the implication of that?
If it's deleted.
No,
it's not deleted.
If it remains.
Yeah.
In that. What is the implication? Okay,
The implications are, Madam Chair, is the aggregate evaluation of the assets and liabilities of that particular company. It's not taken as a structure. And secondly, Madam Chair, to address the second issue by the content specialist where she mentioned the break-even aspect, it's also addressed within the particular, reversing to the particular clause where it speaks about the fair valuations equal or exceed the liabilities. That also addresses the Honourable Party's concern.
These were areas we did agree to, but I'm glad that the content specialist is on board with those changes as well. Okay. 3, 4, 5, 6. 4, was raised again by yourself, Margaret, with respect to an issue. You said clause 4D, page 10, line 2, C, page 72, of summary, replace the act with this act. This is the thing. It is simply, grammar, syntactical, or whatever. And we don't have a problem there. This is not, that wouldn't be substance, okay?
Yes, no.
So we move on. Five, no issues raised, you see. So we are on that six, clause six, which is at the bottom of page 10 of document 2. And if you look at that, clause 6 on document 7 then starts there, and it's, you know, the first response here, if you look at what they, DTI, may have said in that regard, just looking at the relevant section, is this the one on symbols? Yeah, let me just check. The thing is, they agreed with cell number 4 on 6 here, so 6 of the Act, which was a rep, which was raised by KPMG, Barta, and Saika. Is that right? That's right, Ms. Herling. The use of symbols and all of that.
Yeah.
That was an agreement that was reached with the, an agreement that this would be phased in. Can you see there? That has already been agreed with. So if you look at the main point that they raised here in document 7, here. Yes? Oh, sorry, someone is talking. We're actually on clause 6. Clause 6 of the amendment bill, document 2. Page 11, page 10 and 11. Okay. And it's quite a long section. Goes on to page 12.
Okay, if I may. The phase in of clause 6, section 11 in the principal bill, bullet point B2, that talks to the symbols. I just need you to understand, because it also refers, we would also refer to section 218 that actually refers to the phasing in of the period, which is over a 3-year period, and which allows the financial sector to phase that in. But we're only referring to the financial sector. But that with the post office and with the department fall also under that specific clause, or would we have to also give reference to that specific indication, just for a point of clarity on that, number point 2. And it's also my understanding that there's a financial the transfers of financial resources between companies and South Africa and other countries. There are 209 countries that are linked on the SWIFT. They call it the SWIFT system, which deals with capital that gets transferred, and it's my understanding that if those 209 companies, the SWIFT, or let's call it the SWIFT, the so-called SWIFT system, the electronic system, which they do talk about, that it's not compatible to our system. In the case of us or our financial sector being able to, or being forced to go onto this system within the next 3 years, and the international standards or those 209 countries do not accept our standards or our electronics version of the SWIFT system, what then? What is the implications then? Because can we enforce then legislation, our legislation, onto 209 countries on the other side? Yes or no? And these are just some of the decisions that I wanted to make. I do understand the rationale around what we want to achieve. Sometimes if people is not ready, or companies or the bigger financial sector, and then I talk about all 209 countries that are linked to these things, and as the minister is going on like BRICS, and they've got to put certain things in place, one could always put this as amendment, put it in line, and later on always come in and then address the issue as an amendment to the Act later on. And this is just a proposal that I'm making, that we just maybe just park it on one side and make sure that we've got all the agreements with the 209 countries in place first before we do it, because I do not want to see financial companies, the department, the post office, going into an expense which does not eventually actually was necessary to do it because talks and stuff had to be done. And this is just my omission, that we just withhold that for a while and then just proceed with the Act as it is. Thank you.
All right. Are you asking us to flag it?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Before you flag it, let's get the DTI's response, because we're going to break for tea now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the first issue with the Honourable Smollett concerning who is affected by the 3-year coming into operation of a particular clause, it's everybody. It's everybody. It's a clause that says the Minister shall determine the date of 3 years' time for the commencement of that particular section of the law. It doesn't name the banking sector or the post office or any other regulators. It's a general wide clause where they will have to comply with it within a 3-year period. So you don't have to mention anybody by name. Concerning the issue of SWIFT, I think we need to apply our minds a bit here. But what we've been doing in the meantime, Madam Chair, as per instruction by the committee, was to look at areas where the issue of symbols has been used, and amendments to other pieces of legislation, company legislation, where symbols are now allowed. We have been liaising with our UK counterparts, the company's house in the UK, concerning this particular area, and we only actually dealt with it because their laws are very similar to ours, as well as many other company laws in other jurisdictions. And the response that we've got from them thus far, and we're still liaising with them, was that they have not had a problem. They said the systems can read it in terms of various sectors, they therefore will be able to allow some of them. And they've been doing it for a period of time now, and we can make those responses available to the committee accordingly. Concerning the issue of SWIFT, I think we need to go back and ask in particular about that area, because I'm sure being the UK, they're also part of the SWIFT system, and we'll ask them the implications of that as well, and we can make that available.
Well, look, we should accept that response at the moment. In other words, the DTI are going to come back to us. The issue has been raised. The legitimate issue is one final issue raised by Ms. Herling, and that is Ms. Herling.
It's the same issue.
The same issue. Yes, Ms. Honourable Harris.
But yeah, just to clarify, the department's going to go to the UK, for example, and ask how have you managed the implementation of symbols in company names, and secondly, how does that affect your engagement with SWIFT? And they'll come back to us with answers to those two questions.
Well, perhaps more questions, but I'm saying that will certainly be accommodated. Honourable Member Mather.
Chair, I don't think there's 209 countries in the world. I just want to say that. There's 191 at the United Nations. There may be a few others who not. I think we should just, for the record, establish whether it is 209. I don't think there are that many.
No, we've got many new countries now.
All right.
South Sudan.
I think the thing is we need to ask our committee secretary and Ms. Herling to get the number of countries. Certainly South Sudan and the whole Sudanese issue. I mean, it could be that there are things that we're not aware of. We're not even sure if Egypt will remain as one. But at this moment in time, let's get those facts. No, I mean, these facts are easy. You pick up the phone to Durko or something, and they're going to certainly give it to us. But I don't think we have to worry about the number at this point. That wasn't the substance of the issue. Is that correct? So I don't want to now hold Honourable Smiley now accountable for that little stretch of the imagination. So can we just leave this? We're going to go to tea. We're on a break for tea.
I think that's good.
I think training for you takes
Yes, my name. Okay.
Yeah, he will come back on to one
I'm going to go I'm
I think we want to get in another hour, and if we can get that other hour in, we may be able to have made some progress today. I've been reassured by the committee secretary that copies which were requested for the new members and one or two others like Honorable Mabasa, who was away at the time, and Kwabasa, we will also be handing out those copies. We are really asking members who've received endless copies of other documents to go and look for them, please. Because we cannot keep on, it really does come off the committee budget. So we're not going to be doing another exercise of copying summaries, etc., except for new members. Right. So now we are going to be coming back. We were on, I think by now we got into the system of documents. So we're not going to, at least I have myself, and I hope all of you have. We're now going to, we're still on clause 6. Do you recall that? We're just completing that particular process, and I think that the content specialist had raised certain issues in that regard, if I'm correct, and so had yourself, Honorable Somali, in that connection, on in that point. So maybe we can do members feel, that we have exhausted the criteria for clause 6 of the bill. Use of symbols, I think you still had a point you wanted to raise, Ms. Hurling, so please raise it now.
The issue just is, if the committee is in favour of keeping the symbols inside the bill, the hyphen symbol is not being included in the symbol options. And it's one of the things which is quite common and which I think the banks have indicated is not accommodated at the moment.
That's page 11 of document 2, the amendment bill, line 5, 6 or 7. What is it?
Line 6.
Yeah. Is that around the same issue? Yes.
As I understand it, it's been red flagged, and the department will just go and clarify that specific clause that I referred to, and at a later stage we will dispose of the matter then.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you.
Okay, quite right. Let's just get the department's response to the hyphen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if you look at the particular section in the Act, which is section 11, and if you see the last subsection 4, it states that the minister may prescribe additional commonly recognized symbols to be added to the list. So we face two things here. The one is, and I'll make the committee privy to what we've done, we have actually added the hyphen into the regulations because of the fact that the minister can decide. But, as my colleague said, if you pronounce that we put it in the Act, we can put it in.
Yeah.
It's not an issue.
Yeah, okay, another word, we can simply add it if we wish.
Yeah.
Not a big issue, right? But there are several other of these little symbols which the minister would certainly consider in due course and add them to regulations, from what I understand. Yes, did you have your hand up, Honourable Mabasa?
No, I'm covered.
Harris, Honourable Harris.
Thank you. If you'll allow me to stand, if you'll excuse me for standing every now and then, my back is quite full.
I won't take that as a reflection on the proceedings. Yeah. Okay. Right. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's a useful thing. Sitting is a major issue here. Then we're moving, if I look here, I'm just looking at my own foreign languages, etc. Yeah. And then we go to clause 7. Clause 7, page 12 here. There was something which was just simply a typo which I noticed here, if that's correct. And I'm just seeing what you've put there, page 7, see page 15. No, but we were sort of talking about clause 7 here. 7A, you haven't really referred to that. So maybe it was dealt with the department, was it? Yeah, it's simply a small grammar thing. So we're going to pass that one. And I'm sure all of you are aware of that, aren't you? That is line 15, 16, 17 or something. By this, okay? And now we move to clause 8. Is everyone in agreement there? Is everyone aware what was added there? 4. Good. You remember? What was added there?
Madam Chair, on document number 7, on page 4, clause 8, it says there 11, then there's paragraph B, prejudice will affect the identity of not the body corporate, but the juristic person. That was the only proposal in respect of that provision, Madam Chair.
Is everyone on board with clause 8?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right. And that's quite a long one. That page was page 13, right at the bottom line, 60, I think it was, until we move to page 14 there. We look at clause 9. Now, you look here at clause 9, and I've written here deleted. So I'll just confirm. Not really referred to by ourselves directly, although in the one section it is, see page 15 of summary, change 9A, and S, and page 14 and line 30 to read. Now, if you look at, I think this is 7, is this this one here? If you look at document 7, page, and you look at clause 9 there, okay, it's page 4, is that correct? Page 5, never mind what page it is, but it's clause 9. You'll see there that that has been taken account of. So, we don't have anything more to add, let's go to clause. Honourable Salah.
On that page 5,
the mic.
It reads, section 14 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by, then everything is deleted there until you come to E. It says, by substitution in paragraph A of subsection 3 for the words preceding paragraph A of the following words, and there are no following words, unless if those words are in the...
In the actual document.
In the act.
Both 1 and 2.
Madam Chair, I'll be very, very brief. Mm. It's the very same thing that we've had under clause number 6. Mm. It's only the amending phrase which is incorrect, and we had to rectify that. It does not relate to the amendment itself, but only to the amending phrase.
Are you on board the honourable? I think you've got the advocate right next door. You'll just point over here. Right. Okay. All right. So we're all on track again. And then we go to clause 10. I've got here about line 41 and a few pointers made, an insertion possibly. So I'm now looking at document 7. and the insertion in paragraph A of subsection 2. Are we all on the same track here? Of the following subparagraph. I'm on document 7 here. Okay? And you have a B, and you have a Roman small 3 referred to, and going across, it completes it. There's also on page 14 from line 44. You see that there? Further again. I hope we're all on board. Omit paragraph B and insert, and to insert the B would be contain any any restrictive conditions applicable to the company. That I believe we put in that part there. Does everyone understand? We read out the what has been underlined. You know, that's what we're looking at under B. Are we all able to put that together there? And from that, we move on page 14 again, line 48, to insert new B. By the insertion in subsection 2 of the following paragraph. Subsection 2. Skip that. Okay, have we all got that? D, do not include any provision that negates, restricts, limits, qualifies, extends, or otherwise alters the substance or effect of an unalterable provision of this Act, except to extend, to the extent contemplated in paragraph A, small Roman 3. Then I think we must be going to the X. If you look at the X, 71. Is that 140? Page 140 of the X.
It is our document 1, Madam Chair, it's page 66. The section right at the top of 66 is reckless trading prohibited. That is the one that we discussed earlier on this morning.
That is the one that our own consultant also referred to, advisor, and also referred to by DTI. All right? So we've dealt with that already. We have flagged certain issues in that regard. And we're moving on. We now have got a new clause here, which is the amendment of section 22. Again, the same point, you know, the same issue that we just dealt with. Am I right? Do you see that there, that new clause that was put in? Amendment of section 22 of Act 71 of 2008. It is also referring to the issue of business recklessly conducted. Gross negligence. It's an issue we dealt with first. Alright? We then, but before we go there, because we're doing this in order, sorry about that, that's my fault. Clause 11. 11 of document 2, the amendment bill. If you just follow that through, for the sake of the system proceeding as we started. I've made a cross on line 29. I'm not sure why I would have made a cross there, but it would have been during the input of DTI and perhaps also ourselves. The date, if any, set out in the notice of amendment. And the earlier on, it was referred to the date on in time at which the notice of amendment is filed. The filing of the notice of amendment. Can, you know, I don't make notes recklessly myself. So when I see a cross here, it means that it's just something I flagged that the committee they had raised. But we'll carry on, we'll proceed, and I'll make my individual inquiries in that regard. Okay, so we'll leave that one alone for the moment. And then we go to 12, Amendments, Section 19. Again, there, on my notes, I have not raised anything. I've not raised a thing. So, that is when we kick in with Section 22, which I've just referred to down here anyway, and we've dealt with. All right? So go back to Document 2, the Amendment Bill. That is Clause 15. Some of you are also following, I'm sure, up there on the other documents, see page 19 of the summary, page 6 of response, clarify the intention to continually engage in business and within the Republic. That was Clause 14. We didn't raise anything according to my own notes here. Nothing. Right, Clause 15. Of course, Ms. Erling, if we've overlooked something, you ought to say something as well. Okay. Clause 15. Again, on that page, I haven't noted anything. But I do note on Clause 16, we flagged that one. Clause 16. And I see there was a response from DCI on the matter itself. Right? Clause 16. Are we all on track, Ms. Hurling? Any question you want to raise? Right, Clause 16. The references are made there, but over here...
Janet?
Yes?
May I just ask a question? During the debate there, was it the proposal that the and be added after the A?
Which clause are you referring?
Clause 16.
Yes, I'm just coming to that about an insertion. I haven't got down there yet. Yeah. Now, we haven't passed Clause 16. I've just said that you have engaged us on the matter and come back. And we also hear the matter and was raised. And over there, we spoke about an insertion of the addition or insertion of all. Is that correct? We look up there with what Ms. Hurling has as well. Yeah. Right. We then move to, I've simply underlined the other areas, but not raised an issue. We go to Clause 17. Again, we, there's a line there, just a minute, I've not referred to here. Yes. Honourable Harris?
Yeah, sorry, I'm constantly two clauses behind you. The Clause 16, we've accepted the and the or. The other issue raised was about copying.
Yes.
Did I just miss that?
On the copying, what about the copying per se?
The copying, my proposal is that, excuse me.
Yeah. Remember the DCI did come back on that and say that you may not remove original documents if you're coming from, say, FSB or whatever, but you may certainly, you're entitled to read them there on the premises or make a copy. Now, if I look at the actual point made here, I remember that being said right at the beginning. Is this not correct? You also added the in accordance with the promotion to access of information, etc., etc. So I wonder if you're raising another point.
I am, Chair. It's a very simple proposal, and I'll give the justification again. If we look at document 2, the bill,
yeah.
On page 18 and 19, the top of page 19 under well, it's subsection A of section C there. It says, fail to accommodate any reasonable request for access or to unreasonably refuse access to any record that a person has a right to inspect or copy in terms of this section. That's all very well, but the right to copy is not established in this section. Because if you look on the middle of page 18, there's that section 2, which reads, a person not contemplated in subsection 1 has a right to inspect the securities register. The section doesn't establish the right to copy, therefore that clause I mentioned earlier doesn't apply. There's a simple way to amend this, and that's on line 37. We should have changed it to say, has a right to inspect or copy. We insert two words, or and copy.
That's a proposal on the table. Does DTI have a response?
Short response, Chair. We'll be in agreement with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, Ms. Herling, have you got that? No, but I mean, has Ms. Herling got it exactly? Yeah. Because remember, Ms. Herling is now trying to also keep up with us. Right. Let's go to clause 17. On clause 17, as I go through, I'm looking at both the Act and at Document 1 and Document 2. I have got no notes on that one and none on the other one, except where it talks about Section 27 of the Principal Act is hereby amended by the deletion of Subsection 6. Section 27 of the Principal Act. Okay, let's just see that one. Deleted. Everyone on board there? Right. Clause 18. Right, if we're looking at that there. We did have changes, we did have suggestions put forward by DTI, both on subsection 5 there, line 19 it must have been, and then again probably 21 or so. So let's just have a look here. Section 29. All right. Subsection 5. You see, so there we are. It's right there about substitution and Section 5 for the paragraph B of the following paragraph. Okay? Got it there? Everyone on the track? Right. And then we go further on to... I'm trying to look at my own... read my own writing. Clarify it. Okay. And that is further on in the same one. This is now 19... Clause 19, okay. There's quite a lot there that we wrote. There's also the input of DTI and someone here, may have been yourself, Honourable Mabasa, raised issues of co-ops and auditors and that kind of thing. Not sure if you made notes, but the issue of co-ops is raised there as well. Do you recall that, DTI? With respect to auditors? Okay. And you went on to say that we do not need to remove, etc., etc. Okay. So let's see what you did agree on. You then agreed on page 20 from line 2 to omit subsection 2A. Amidst subsection 2A. Go across the page. 20. Amidst subsection 2A. Where am I? Yeah, there we are. Even longer. Right? And insert what we have here. Virtually a new 2A. Are we all on board there? Right. I think a question was asked, it was clarified. Okay, regarding the co-ops. We then have also here, someone perhaps you can tell me, G there, new clause 3 insertion. Was this here?
Madam Chair, in fairness to the committee, the whole proposal that we have here in document number 7 under clause 19, that is on page 7, was not part of the document that was presented to the committee on the 9th of February. It is one of the new additions to the document. It flows from the so-called GAPS document that we discussed at the earlier meeting. So it is a new proposal for consideration by the committee. If I may just say very, very briefly, the first one there under number 1, clause 19 of document number 7, on page 7, what it provides for is in those cases where all the securities issued by a company are held by its directors, all securities held by directors, then such a company will be exempt from having its annual financial statements audited or independently reviewed. Save for two instances where, for instance, the minister would prescribe by regulation that irrespective of that exemption, the company falls into a category where auditing or independent review is required, then the exemption would not apply, or possibly another instance where the exemption would not apply is where a company is required in terms of another law or in terms of a separate agreement to have its financial statements audited, then the exemption would equally not apply. The one at the bottom of page 7 of document number 7 is also a new insertion, was not part of the previous document. It simply gives a ministerial power to make regulations regarding the duties of persons conducting independent reviews, and also a further power for the accreditation of professions whose members may conduct such reviews. I merely point that out in fairness because it was not part of the previous document.
Chair,
okay.
May I make one just add it does not flow clearly from the document, but the duties that we've added here basically refer to a discussion at the previous meeting where the duty to report certain irregularities when under independent review came to light was discussed. And we promised during that we will do something to the Act to make sure that the minister will be able to make regulations in this regard. And then also for the professions that needs to be identified for independent reviews.
I mean, I wrote here there'll be a new clause 3, you know, that in fact, not clause 3, but section that in fact has been dealt with there. And you call it A, B, and various other things, and so on and so forth. So, members, this was in response to issues we raised in the matter. And we can then move to that in order. There's also
referring to document 1?
Document 1, page
18.
Section 32, use of company name and registration, and yet the issue that was coming up with financial information at the time I printed here. So what you've done is you've also added on and 7, subsection 7. All right?
How close is
it? Just take us through that, please.
Madam Chair, there are on that page, page 80, right at the bottom of the page, we have those two subsections, 6, to be omitted from the bill. Not only 6, but also 7 should have been part of that amending clause. So those two subsections are right at the bottom of page 80. If the amendment is accepted, they would be omitted from the principal act.
Are we all on board there? Right, okay, we're going to move then, if we are. Just the addition there of 7, you know, which came at our request, you know, we need to look at things again. The amendment of, so we then have clause 21. We didn't have any, we didn't raise any issue there at the time. Honourable Harris?
Yeah, I'm afraid I'm still on clause 19. The in document 5, the DTI agrees to page 8. So page 8 of document 5. There's the question was raised around the transitional arrangement for audit requirements. The DTI is quoted here saying that it's recommended that an appropriate change to the bill be made to the effect that, and then it describes what will happen what the transitional arrangement will be. That needs to be reflected in the amendment as well.
Can I answer that, Madam Chair? It is reflected and done in clause 118 of the transitional arrangement, right toward the end of document 7.
Document 7 clause
118.
Transitional arrangement was called or something else. Okay. Everyone on track now. We were on 21 where I said there was nothing raised by the committee. We then had clause 22. On here I've made no notes specifically in the area. In other words, there was an agreement with what had been responded to, etc., to the submissions. I'm also looking up at the top. And then clause 23. We're all still on track here. I'm also watching my time, clause 23. That again, there are some issues raised. There, see page, the summary. And in fact, there is a DTI did come back with some of the issues which had been raised, and that was reflected here as well on document 7. We all see that. Section 37 is hereby amended by the insertion of the subsection 8, after subsection 8. And it must be of the act, of the actual act itself. That should be about 82, is it? Let's see what it is. 84, 86. Okay, subsection 8. on that act. So we have here what is being proposed. Is that right? A person acquires the rights associated with any particular securities of a company, and when that person's name is entered in the company, etc., etc., it's all there. These were some of the issues raised during the responses and our engagement with DTI. This is what they're coming up with here. When I say coming up with, it's their response here. But in fact, it was there right at the beginning as well, from what I could see. I'm looking at both. So it's not something that was added subsequent to that. It was there all the time, and we didn't seem to have any difference on the matter. Captured that, Ms. Hurling? Right. We then go to clause 24, is it? Clause 24. Again, I'm looking at this here. I don't see anything here that we've made, but I see up here, we're talking, I think, from the Act, the original, the removal of 60-day grace period for the retroactive, what was it? Retroactive shares issue. Okay, let's just look at that then. That's, Act 71, that's 38. It's on the same page, though, isn't it? Just below it follows the issuing of shares. Now, in yours here, you haven't really referred to a 24 in the latest. It seems to have some wrong.
Yeah, maybe I can just give you guidance there.
Yeah.
DTI did not respond to this.
No.
The committee referred it to your independent consultant,
yeah,
and she responded to, yes, to it on document 10, page
11,
2.
That's 11, that's particular one, 11.
No,
so there's two of them, you remember.
Yeah.
One was the 14th, one was the 15th, so we said 10 and 11.
I'm
talking
the wrong way around.
Okay, number 11. Document 11. So we do have it here. You can read it. The opinion follows two-thirds of the way down. In my opinion, the inclusion of a time period of retrospective authorization is a desirable addition. That is what our own advisor is saying. It imposes an obligation on companies that wish to regularize the issue to act reasonably quickly to remedy the irregularity, which limits the opportunity, etc. The only issue is whether 60 business days is the correct period to impose for the obtaining of the retrospective authority under Section 36. Now, I must assume DTI would only have read this morning, this response, because that's when we received it. In order to put the necessary authorization in place under Section 36, and thus retrospectively validate the issue, the company would have to amend the authorized capital provisions in its MOI, etc. It then goes on to indicate how that would be done. Alternatively, if the MOI does not permit the board to make the changes under Section 36.3, it will be necessary to amend the MOI by way of special resolution of shareholders. Given the time it would take to obtain such a special resolution and to file a notice of amendment to make the special resolution effective, 60 business days does not seem unduly generous. You know, advocates have this way of lowercase diplomacy. I had to then understand what was meant, because, you know, for me, when coming from not an English, you know, you have to negate generous, and it's not, I wonder, it's okay.
It is generous,
not unduly. No, I just don't think we need to then, as far as she's concerned, then we could move on it. Is that my understanding?
Yeah, you're right.
So here we are, that's dealt by her. We're then moving to section 25, is it? Clause 25, is that correct? Hope I'm correct. Yeah. But then you also had another clause here. But that's 39. So we haven't reached there yet. We haven't reached there. 25, we didn't raise anything. In my notes. Clause 26, we didn't raise anything. In my notes. 27, no.
I'm so sorry, pardon the interruption, Madam Chair. That new clause, page 9 of document 7, that relates to section 39 of the Act.
Okay.
So that would become, if it would be accepted by the committee, that would become a new clause just before clause 25, if you would like maybe to deal with it in that slot. And
that's that one where it was the subscription of shares I'm seeing here. There were issues here, one or two. In fact, that did take a bit of time. Okay, so the proposal is coming here, new clause.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And once again, it was not part of the document that was presented on the 9th of February. It's new, it's additional, it's flowing from the GAPS document once again. It is fairly simple, Madam Chair. It's a matter of better language or phrasing or grammar, if you wish. Merely for the insertion of the words for, as we see them there, subscribe for fewer shares, subscribe for under that subsection, subscribe for. There's nothing more to it than that.
What we would call a technical syntactical amendment. There were quite a few of those we see to go through here. I mean, this is not a substance issue per se, it's clarification. Right. So we move on. This is where the numbering is going to have to be looked at, Advocate Hercules, in this regard, with things changing.
Yes, Chair, with all new clauses being inserted in the bill, and the clauses that will be deleted, we'll have to change the numbering accordingly, and that will be reflected in the bill.
Okay. 27 we were on, 28 we were on, clause 29, okay, we did have certain areas that we raised in this regard. Now, and that's section 48 of the Act, etc. Section 48 of the Principal Act is hereby amended. I'm looking at document 7. By the substitution for the subsection 1 of the following. This section does not apply to the, and then we come to the actual point, A. All right, let's just see where we are here. We're talking about the principal act also involved, okay? Yeah, I'm just taking my time as well, but it is A. It is A there, right? And we all got that, and also perhaps got the Principal Act up in front of us as well. I have seen the hand, so we don't have to worry. Seen the hand. If you look at the Principal Act here, it's this issue. I've written shares, page 8, whatever I meant by that. Right, Honourable Harris.
Yeah, I think we missed clause 28.
Well, I did say clause 28, but as you say, you're just following perhaps in great detail. And I noted that I haven't got any notes there. That's what I noted, so I then moved to clause 29.
Okay, then can I request, if we can do clause 28, I would request someone in the DTR to explain the response that they've written on page 9 of document 5. Because you'll see that Weber Wenzel and the Banking Association requested a new provision, and the DTI disagreed, and I haven't got my head around that.
Page 9 of that particular document, which is
the comment simply is that the amendment bill has got no provision there, and they suggest one is needed to prevent an unintended consequence that would inhibit intercompany cash transfers and loans among the members of a group of companies. And the DTI has written, I'm sure you're all reading from the same document I am I right? Document 5. I think it's, yeah. But if you're not, this DTI disagreed and said that Section 45 was crafted as it is to prevent asset stripping from one company within a group to the detriment of the company's creditors. The DTI is not satisfied that the proposed amendment will not negate the protection against asset stripping. The issue is around asset stripping. Right. Now, DTI, as not, am I right, Margaret? I'm just looking at yours up there. Andre can read it there. And these are the loans that you're looking at. This is the issue put up. We did, in fact, now that I think of it, that's why, although it's not noted on the amendment bill directly, simply on the Act, is lying down, which means we must have discussed it. And that was that. Once we got the DTI explanation, we must have been satisfied. Do you want to explain it again? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. The section in the Act is Section 45, yes, and it deals with loans and financial assistance to directors. So the requirement that if such financial assistance or loans are given to a director, it must be fair and reasonable to the company to be able to provide it. That is where the idea behind the prevention of asset stripping is coming in. So it must, should not be fair and reasonable to the director per se, but it must be fair and reasonable to the company. And that is the basic idea behind this amendment.
So what motivated you itself was to avoid asset stripping, to prevent it in some way as far as possible.
The test for such a financial instrument is twofold. The company must not suffer its solvency or liquidity situation, and it must also be fair and reasonable to the company.
Right.
So it's more than just the solvency and liquidity test that we are adding with the proposal in the bill is to add an additional criteria.
At the time, the majority must have felt that they were happy with that because I didn't note anything here to raise it again. 29, clause 29, there is an amendment noted here on document 7, and that referring that was to amendment of section, let's see, proposals that are made, but that's where we were just at that time when I was just asking for the line to be given to me by DTI in that regard. We can see that it's A. You know, that wasn't the point. So the line itself in the Amendment Bill, Document 2. On page 22.
If I may, Madam Chair, this would be a new insertion. On page 22 of the bill, immediately after line number 7. So it will be the new A under clause 29.
It's a new A.
It will be a new A immediately where we start with clause 9 in the bill. And just to refresh our memories, just very, very briefly, this proposal deals with the redemption of redeemable securities
those securities being in essence redeemable within a certain period of time, and that such redemption should not be considered as a share buyback. That was the issue.
Are we all understanding that? Right. Can we then we then go on to clause 30. All right. Amendment of section 49. I haven't got any notes. All right, I've got no notes here. So if you want to raise something, you raise it. You see, no issues raised. I see the content specialist agree. Clause 31. Clause 32, I haven't made any notes. Clause 33. Clause 34. Now I'm just looking. 33 does indicate there the content specialist has raised something which we would have raised. It would have looked at the summary, and then it's a technical issue in any event. Right. We then go to clause 34. I haven't got any issues raised. I'm just looking here. I'm sure all of you made notes on here. Clause 36. Clause 36. I heard you, Honourable Ambrosini. Clause 37. Now, there was something raised there about annual general notices. It says on that document we're looking at right now is document 3. See page 63 of summary. Allow the notice of AGMs to include either financial statements or summaries. Do you remember that issue that came up? Why can't we have summaries? Well, you know, must it be the full issue? That was all that we raised. DDI did not really respond on the matter. So, are you happy with what do you want to go with then? Are you going to prepare an amendment as a committee then that you want to change it? Because that's what we've raised, the issue. So maybe we'll flag it as we finalise issues. Right.
Chair, can I maybe just respond to that?
Yes.
And just to put it into perspective, the Act as it currently is worded in Section 62.3 says that if you send out a notice of an AGM, you must include a summary of the financial statements. People say that's an additional burden, additional cost, so they want the committee to also allow them to attach the financial statements without being summarized. They just said it's extra work to make a summary. So it's really here or no.
Okay, well, the committee will apply its mind to either or, you know. So let's leave that one. As we said, we leave it for the moment. I'm also having to watch my time here, and I then look at section 38. No issues were raised. Section 39, there was clause 38, no issues. Clause 39, there's something that may have been raised. Let me just see. No, by ourselves, because we have also, what is the, yeah, let's just see what was raised here. Just a small thing. It's a removal, it's a technicality. So we're not applying our minds there. Then we go to clause 40. It's the last one we're dealing with today. As such, clause 40, unless we just deal with 41 where there was nothing to apply our minds to per se. 40, right. Clause 40, we have here an amendment on that as requested, okay, if you look at your document 7. And that is, it's dealing with 65 of the Principal Act, and there's several substitutions. It was to do with removal of directors. You just get that. No, hang on, it's not quite the same thing at all. No. Dear, I mustn't listen to you there. When I hear you saying removal of directors. No. 65 is shareholder resolutions here. A is not for me to listen to side comments and focus on what I've got. And in fact, I've written your name here, so you must have raised the issue. Yeah, so there we are. And then we have addressed it here. We said that this was coming here. There's an insertion, etc., etc. And about a substitution to subsection 11. You see, there it is right there at about 54, line 54. Am I right? On the Act, if you look at that. And if you look at the document 2, the amendment bill, we would want to substitute the subsection. But you see, you're looking at the Act with that amendment, you know, as proposal. So that's fine. The issues raised there were really in terms of the memorandum of incorporation, the whole issue of the resolutions, which we have to some extent addressed. Is there any other issue you want to address today, Honourable Smalley, having seen now the extended points that were made here by DTI? Come back again on Friday if you like. Right. So that will be flagged. Honourable members, I agree that we would try to close off just before 1 to allow members to go back to their respective offices, etc., and get some lunch before 2 o'clock, and that is exactly what we're going to do. We are meeting on Friday. Pardon? At 40. You see, if you jump ahead like that, you may miss some important provisions. But yes, we have stopped there. 40 was flagged, so we are on 41. So what time on Friday, if I can hand over just to the committee as secretary?
The committee meeting on Friday starts at 9 o'clock in room E249 from 9 until 1:30.
1:30?
In which room again?
Group E249.
E249. You know, that's where some, debates or some tells and the like. We're going to be there. We also, you know, don't want to cripple people in terms of their flights. So the Whip and I will discuss certain issues there. So if you recall, I had one stage I spoke about possibly continuing until 3, and not everyone was very happy. So I know that we will try to bring this closer to the morning. Thanks. Meeting is adjourned.
This is run. 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 This